Well, there is, of course, a lot of focus today on what's happening in Syria, but the U.S. is also targeting ISIS in Iraq, just the latest chapter in a century of U.S. involvement in that country. And we want to look now at today's events in the context of that history with Peter Hahn, chair of the History Department at Ohio State University and author of Missions Accomplished, the U.S. and Iraq Since World War I. And Peter, let's go back to the beginning of the 20th century. U.S. oil interests in Iraq existed even then, as early as 1910. U.S. oil corporations were looking for opportunities in Iraq.
That's right. The British had led the way with exploring for oil in the Middle East, making the first big find in Persia, modern-day Iran, in 1907. U.S. companies were fast on their heels, prospecting, searching, trying to discover reserves, and working out deals with local governing authorities to ensure steady access of that oil to Western markets.
So, as you mentioned, the British were key in the post-World War I era in Iraq. What did they do to the government, and what did that mean for the United States?
Britain wanted to extend its imperial reach as a victor of World War I. They were drawn to Iraq because of its proximity to the Persian Gulf, because it was on the supply line to India, the great British colony, because of its oil resources, because of its grain resources and its potential market for British exports. There was local resistance. There was an Iraqi rebellion against British rule in the immediate aftermath of World War I, but the British Army rather handily and ruthlessly suppressed that rebellion. And then it developed a typical imperial scheme in which it provided international security and strategic management of the economy, but relied on local Iraqi collaborators to govern the country internally, of course, completely at the behest and subject to the approval of British authorities. Out of that came, in the interwar period, the emergence of an Iraqi state. The mandate was officially declared to be independent in the early 1930s. A royal family was identified as being the governing authority. A parliament took shape. But those in control in Baghdad were hand-selected or at least hand-approved by British imperial authorities.
And of course, as this is all happening, the build to World War II is occurring around the world, and that changes the power structure. The United States becomes a much bigger power than it was before and sort of takes on the role that Britain had pre-World War II in Iraq as the master of the chessboard, if you will.
That's right. And the dynamic there played out across the Middle East and through much of the developing world, in which the U.S. gradually supplanted Britain as the leading Western power, managing the region on behalf of what were identified as common Western interests. There was briefly perceived to be a Nazi threat to Iraq, meaning that the Nazis would somehow infiltrate and take over the country and turn its resources against the Western military effort. That frightened American leaders. They initially rallied to Britain's side, and then they came to fear the same type of thing about the Soviet Union by the late 1940s, and they resolved that someone would have to make sure that the Soviets didn't infiltrate and take over that country like the Nazis seemingly had come close to doing. The second part of the equation was that World War II essentially began the end of the British Empire. The U.S. saw that vacuum being created in the British structure. They feared a Soviet menace. They decided they had to get involved to assure common Western strategic and economic interests.
So in 1958, there is this Iraqi revolution. They overthrow the monarchy. And over the next 20 years or so, the U.S.-Iraqi relations are not very good. But then along comes a man that we now know very well, Saddam Hussein.
Right. That 20 years was a time of profound political instability in Iraq. The country experienced two decades of constant political turmoil, a series of coups and suspected coups and attempted coups that left the country unstable on the political front. During that time, the U.S. sort of held Iraq at some distance. It had other countries in the region that were of a higher priority. It realized that it had limited ability to affect positive change when compared to the risks within Iraq. The fear that the Soviets would immediately infiltrate and take over proved to be unfounded. In fact, the Iraqi leaders of that time were as anti-Russian as they were anti-American. They feared Soviet imperialism as much as they feared Western. So they sort of stayed independent, and American leaders during that two decades were willing to accept that situation because there didn't seem to be any pressing need to try to change it. All of that indeed changed when Saddam Hussein emerged at the top of the power pyramid in Baghdad in 1979, in part because of the character of him as a statesman and in part because of the aggressive foreign policy that he immediately launched against his neighbors. He not only upset the apple cart, he destabilized the region and forced U.S. leaders and others to try to figure out how to manage Saddam and how to promote or save political stability across the region in the face of the turmoil caused by Saddam.
And of course, as we now know, the U.S. then got dragged into two wars in Iraq and now the situation that we are in today. We're speaking with Peter Hahn, chair of the History Department at Ohio State University and author of Missions Accomplished, the U.S. and Iraq Since World War I. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Peter Hahn about the century-long history of U.S. involvement in Iraq. Peter is the chair of the History Department at Ohio State University and author of the book Missions Accomplished, The United States and Iraq Since World War I. And we were talking before the break about the rise of Saddam Hussein. And Peter, let's pick up there. What was the relationship between the U.S. and Saddam in the early years?
In the early years, it was a distant partnership, one based on a common enemy. And by that, I mean Iran. 1979, incidentally, the year that Saddam Hussein took power in Baghdad, was also the year that Ayatollah Khomeini and the religious extremists of his revolution knocked out the Shah of Iran and took charge of that country. And Khomeini was deeply anti-American because of the legacy of American covert operations in his country. His revolution was idealistic. It was forceful. It vowed to spread his form of Islam across the region. The hostage crisis had inflamed American passions against Iran. And Saddam Hussein initially was seen as a potential bulwark against Iran and the potential for its influence to spread to the West. In the fall of 1980, Saddam provoked a war against Iran, a major war, by launching a broad-based military invasion of his neighbor. That war was fought over an eight-year period. It was catastrophic for both sides, more than a million casualties, cities laid to waste, weapons of mass destruction used, attacks on shipping in the Persian Gulf. And during that war, because of its concern with Iran, the Reagan administration generally backed Iraq, not because it liked Iraq, not because it had good values, not because they trusted Saddam, but because Saddam was standing in the path of a potential explosion of Iranian influence across the area.
And when you say they backed Iraq, does that mean they were supplying arms or what were they doing?
Arms, money, intelligence, eventually interdiction of Iranian naval activities on the Gulf. By 1987-88, the U.S. Navy was at war with the Iranian Navy. There were a series of incidents through the Gulf over a two-year period, almost all of them won handily by the U.S. Navy. Again, the U.S. strategy was to keep Saddam from losing because he was seen as the bulwark against Iranian expansion.
And they were successful. He didn't lose. And
that's
then
correct.
With the confidence perhaps of not losing, he decided to invade Kuwait in 1990, which is something the U.S. did not want him to do.
That's right. And there was a decisive watershed in the U.S.-Iraqi relationship. Saddam's attack on Iran had been tolerated and even supported. His invasion of Kuwait was seen as completely illegitimate and something that had to be stopped. The first President Bush resolved almost immediately, as he put it, this aggression shall not stand.
It is my hope that somehow the Iraqi people can, even now, convince their dictator that he must lay down his arms, leave Kuwait, and let Iraq itself rejoin the family of peace-loving nations.
And he led the construction of a well-constructed international coalition that used diplomacy and eventually military force to compel Saddam to withdraw from Kuwait and surrender the prize of his aggression.
Why is that? Why was the U.S. so concerned about Saddam taking Kuwait?
Well, a couple of reasons. The larger global context was key. The Cold War had just ended, and the Bush administration was trying to envision what President Bush liked to call the New World Order of the post-Cold War era. And everyone around the world was idealistic that now that the Cold War was seemingly over, we could build a new international order based on peace and stability and states living as good neighbors with one another. And Saddam immediately emerged as the first contestant against that new world order. And so there was a feeling that he had to be handled promptly, made an example of, if you will, so that the rest of the world would understand that that type of behavior was not going to be tolerated in the post-Cold War era. More to the point, U.S. leaders realized that, you know, maybe Saddam's values had to be rejected and repudiated. They could no longer be tolerated because he had negotiated a truce with Iran and Iran had come under new leadership. There was less of a fear of Iranian expansion as there had been in 1980. There were also very tangible concerns, material concerns, like the control of oil. There was fear that if Saddam were allowed to get away with the conquest of Kuwait, he would immediately move into Saudi Arabia and points beyond. He could soon be in control of a majority of the world's proven oil reserves. And the idea of a guy like Saddam Hussein having that much power over Western economies was something that President Bush just couldn't stomach. It was also a war that the U.S. figured it could win and win rather handily. And to his credit, I think President Bush accomplished that.
But then, of course, he was not reelected. And the policy of the U.S. was to keep Saddam in a cage in Iraq and basically have a policy of containment, which lasted through 9/11. And then, of course, as we know, the second Bush administration went back into Iraq saying that there were weapons of mass destruction there post 9/11. But let's skip that because there's that we could do an entire show on that. And what I want to get to is today, does the U.S. have any responsibility for the rise of ISIS? If you go back over the history of our involvement with Iraq and the different parties that we have backed in Iraq, do we have responsibility for the rise of ISIS?
Well, there's plenty of culpability to go around, and to a certain degree, one could pin blame on the U.S. because it upset the order of Saddam Hussein's Iraq in 2003. And its efforts to control what followed to build a new Iraq on a democratic model came to naught. On the other hand, had the Sunnis been united behind Maliki or behind the government of Baghdad under some other leadership, as they were at the moment the U.S. left the country, at the moment when the surge ended in 2008, maybe ISIS would not have been able to exploit conditions and move as quickly and dramatically as they did.
So, Peter Hahn, as you see the U.S. go back in with more and more military advisors to Iraq and get more involved, what do you think? Is this folly or does it make sense to you? Does it make sense that the U.S. is constantly being drawn back into Iraq?
It makes sense because Iraq continues to have strategic importance for the U.S. and for the international community in general for some of the same familiar reasons like oil. But also because of the symbolism there. If a barbaric regime like ISIS should prove that it can govern territory and establish statehood as it has declared, unrecognized by the world, then it could become a thorn in the side of the region and a destabilizing factor in international affairs for a long time to come. And the way they govern, the way they maltreat the civilians under their control, the types of threats that they have made to their neighbors, the expansionist tendencies they've demonstrated, they're dangerous. I wouldn't say they're existentially dangerous. I don't envision them conquering America or destroying the U.S. They're nothing on the scale of past adversaries like Nazi Germany, nowhere close, but they're dangerous. They could cause harm, grievous harm to many people for many years to come. And so I would advocate that the U.S. government come up with a conceived and properly constructed and multilateral policy for dealing with that danger in a way that hopefully will be effective.
Peter Hahn, chairman of the History Department at Ohio State University and author of Missions Accomplished, The United States and Iraq Since World War I. Peter Hahn, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.